You're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to the Ready Room, show number 37, Stroking Lobes for Profit. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Greg Harbin. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including the TNG Exposed panel coming to Calgary in April, IDW's Star Trek Doctor Who crossover comic and other May comic titles, Hasbro's Creo bricks and Creon figures, and movie news and rumors. Plus, we'll also reveal another of our rejected Star Trek 4 plots. Then, in the feature, we're joined by Brian Finifter and Tristan Riddell as we discuss the Deep Space Nine episode, Culess. So, let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Mike. How are you this week?
I'm doing good, Dan. How are you?
I'm doing okay. You know, it's too bad that Greg and Chris couldn't make it this week. So we do have Mike Harbin and Dan Jones here with you.
Yes.
On the Ready Room.
Yes. I think this might be obscure and we probably don't even need to explain it, but I am now Mike.
That's right. As you told me on iMessage, people can now find you on Twitter at Mike Harbin, where right. You mostly tweet about how your name is now Mike.
Exactly. Oh, well.
All right. So now that we've lost everyone here at the beginning of the show, right. What's happening over there in Seattle, Greg?
Well, now that I am Mike and not Greg, I'm dressing the part. I know this is an audio-only podcast, but I am dressed. I've actually leveled up to a tie this week. I see, Chris, you're not wearing a tie. What? Is this show not good enough for a tie?
Well, you know, Greg, I'm not wearing a tie this week. However, I am supporting you in that I did dress for the show. I've got on my dress shirt. I've got on my black jacket.
Nice.
I'm missing a tie, but hey, I'm not wearing my Alabama sweatshirt this time. So that's something.
I was starting to wonder if you just wear the Alabama sweatshirt just all week, and I just see you again, and you're still wearing it.
Pretty much. You know, I'm like on Japanese variety shows, you know, how everyone right. has their look, their little shtick.
Yes.
Like the guy that wears the pink sweater vests. And he's got, every time you see him, it doesn't matter if it's a commercial, if it's right. a variety yep. show. No matter what's going on, doesn't matter if it's a show where they're like dumping them into shark tanks and dragging them out, he's always wearing a pink sweater vest. And so it's kind of like that. You know, I have a closet full of these Alabama sweatshirts. They're all identical.
I see.
And I just wear them all the time.
It's like that scene in Batman Returns. No, not that one. Not that one. Ah, this is the Alabama sweatshirt that's right for today.
That's right. Fourth one from the left.
Yes.
That's the one I always wear on show days.
Very good. Well, what's happening in the world of Star Trek this week?
Well, it's actually, you know, I have been so busy this week with some business things. I wasn't really able to write as much news for the website as I would like to. And so when I went in and I checked to see what was going on, I found that there's actually quite a lot happening
yeah.
as opposed to the previous week where it just wasn't a lot. Now, I don't know if that's because it's President's Day in the U.S. this Monday or, you know, what the deal is. Maybe everyone is celebrating President Jonathan Archer, first president of the Federation.
That's definitely what I'm doing on President's Day. I'm definitely glad that there wasn't that much news last week so that we could spend so much time talking about the packaging of the TNG Blu-ray.
I know, I was editing the show and I think I tweeted that I can't believe we just spent 15 minutes talking about the packaging of TNG The Next Level.
Priorities.
Maybe that's why we had a 2-hour and 15-minute show last week. Anyway, but one of the things that caught my eye, as everyone knows, this is the 25th anniversary year of The Next Generation.
Yeah.
And coming up at the Calgary Comic and Entertainment Expo, there's going to be an event called TNG Exposed. That's Expo in all caps, of course.
Right. It's not the TNG cast naked. It's just the TNG cast will be there, I believe. That's my understanding.
Right. Yeah. There is not going to be a Beta Z wedding at the Calgary Comic-Con, but, you know, you never know.
You never know. It's Canada.
You know, Riker's going to be there, so who knows.
Yeah, but I believe everyone's going to be there. I mean, they've got Stewart, Frakes, Spiner, McFadden, Burton, Sirtis, Dorn, Crosby, Wheaton. Who's missing? I think Cole Meany. I don't see him there.
Right. I think Chase Masterson is still trying to get onto this panel.
I don't think she was on TNG, Chris. Unless I'm mistaken.
Does that really matter?
Probably not.
Yeah, but they have pretty much everyone here. I think, yeah, even Denise Crosby is there.
Right.
As you are. Now, I may have to boycott this because I do not see Diane Mulder on here. So if there's no Pulaski, I don't think you can really call it the entire principal cast of Star Trek The Next Generation.
It's the principal cast of season 3 and parts of 4.
Boy, they're getting really specific here.
Yes.
I see.
It's for, you know, it's for that sort of fan. You know, you're not a fan of season 1. You're really not a fan of season 2. After Wheaton left the show, you sort of stopped caring so much. So it's really hitting that niche of people who love that beautiful moment at the middle.
Yeah, that's true. Well, if you do like that, you can go and this is going to be on February 18th. And actually, I'm sorry, the tickets go on sale February 18th.
Yes.
The actual event is going to be April 27th to 29th. And Greg, I'm not totally clear here on if the cast is going to be there for the whole expo or if this is only happening on the 28th, because they say that they will all appear together at a reunion event on the 28th. But I kind of gathered from the information that we've gotten that they're going to be there individually or in pairings over the three-day period, you know, to sign autographs and do those sorts of things.
Right. I mean, it's the sort of thing we talked about with the Los Angeles convention, where if you want a picture with Wheaton and Gates McFadden, you go on a certain day, you pay, you know, your $30. You want a picture with Stewart and Frakes, you go on a certain day, you pay your $100. You want your picture with the Tribble, you pay $200.
Yeah.
And if you want a picture with the Glommer, you know, that's one day only. It's about an hour. You register in advance, $500 to get a picture with the Glommer. So it's that sort of thing. You've got to go at specific times to see specific people.
Exactly.
But yeah, they'll have the whole crew together for, like, you know, it's sort of like those Survivor reunions where you have everybody on couches and just ask them about their experiences. So that's what I'm most looking forward to if I'm able to go. As you said, it is at the end of April, a couple months away. It's possible. We'll
see.
I think
what you're alluding to here, Greg, is that at this event, they're going to have the Glommer on the couch, and you can ask the Glommer, you know, what is it like to eat a Tribble?
Well, you have the Glommer on one couch, and you have the Tribble on the other couch, and they're just eyeing each other the whole night. It's really uncomfortable.
Yeah. Well, I think they're going to start by interviewing the Tribble, and then they're going to say, and guess who's here tonight? And then they bring the Glommer from backstage. It's kind of that space Jerry Springer moment there.
Right. Glommer, 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 Glommer.
But you know, Greg, you keep sending me messages about how hungry you are because you didn't eat dinner. And I tell you, you know, you really have to eat. You got to keep up your strength. And you tell me that you're saving your money for that $500 Glommer ticket.
Right.
And I keep telling you that if you don't eat, you're not going to have enough energy to get to Calgary. So
right.
I think you got to find some balance there.
I'm gonna see what I can do. You know, it is April. I have actually have a friend in Calgary, which I think adds a little bit of incentive for me to go. So we'll see. Hopefully it won't sell out immediately and I'll be able to make this decision in March sometime. Hopefully this will be the first Trek FM covered event like this, at least from the two of us. So it looks to be a great thing. And this is the first time they've had all those people together for an event like this in quite some time. That's my understanding, at least.
I think so. Maybe for a while. I don't remember who was in Las Vegas, but even if they were, I don't know that they had everybody together on one panel like this.
Right.
So
it's more just like appearances here and there, signatures.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, everyone may have been in the same place somewhere, but this is actually gathering everyone together for a kind of a reunion. So
exactly, yeah, and I'm sure they'll be talking about the TNG Blu-ray as well. I think they were talking about this on Dork Trek, how the Blu-rays come out, and who would buy such a thing with just 3 episodes on it for $20? And I looked over at my copy of the Blu-ray and was like, yeah, I'm the sort of person who would do that. So.
Well,
they know
their
target audience.
I think that was the general sentiment leading up to it. But after so many people have gotten it and tweeted about it, I think pretty much everybody who's a fan of The Next Generation is going ahead and springing for it.
Yeah.
It's, I don't know. I mean, if you think, around $20 for three episodes, it's kind of steep. But then again, it's not that much. And it's such a treat to watch it. So.
Oh, it is. It is. I mean, I can't wait for the full set. I'm really hoping that in Calgary, they're going to show some clips from new episodes that they're working on. And get more of a taste of what's coming in season one, because that's really what I'm excited for, is getting the whole of season one and seeing a lot of that stuff. I mean, there's episodes in there that are actually really good, even though it's still first season. So anyway, I'm sure that'll be a big topic in Calgary at the end of April.
I'm pretty sure that on Justice, for example, you're going to be able to see, you know, bees sitting on the flowers as Wesley jumps into them.
Exactly. You'll understand. That's why they had to kill him, because of the bees that he disturbed. You know, it's not just the flowers and the fence, but those bees are precious.
Exactly. It's not the flowers at all. It's bees are an endangered species.
Right. Well, see, that's what you didn't understand, that the bees were an important part of their ecosystem. And they knew that if they didn't protect the bees, you know, in 100, 200, 300 years, what was going to show up in orbit around their planet? But the bee probe.
Oh,
emitting,
man, the bee probe. Yeah.
Into the atmosphere, boiling the oceans, pollinating the flowers.
I know. The flowers start blooming so rapidly, and the pollen that comes off those things starts surrounding the planet in a thick layer of pollen and blocking out the sun. And then, you know, the Enterprise, this time it's going to be the Next Generation crew, the Enterprise D, but they have to slingshot around the Edo sign, travel back in time, gather some bees, and a beekeeper. That's the thing. They're going to bring, Jean-Luc's going to fall in love with a beekeeper from the past, bring her into the future.
And this is all because of Wesley Crusher, because Wesley Crusher couldn't just stand there, and he had to just run like a bumbling idiot. So these are the sort of things we'll know because of the Blu-ray. And just imagine all of the other little details that we had no idea about once that first season Blu-ray is released.
Well, make sure that if you do make it to Calgary, be sure that you do ask them about this storyline here.
Yes, I definitely will.
As they're sitting on the sofas together.
Well, speaking of drug trips around the sun, it looks like something that's coming out soon is a Next Generation Doctor Who crossover comic. And I don't know whose idea this was, but I think there may have been some LDS involved.
I think someone did do a little too much LDS here. It continues the fine tradition that started last year of Star Trek and other comic crossovers that just make you scratch your head a little bit. We had the Legion of Superheroes original series crossover, and now we have the Next Generation Doctor Who crossover. Now, we're probably going to get a little bit of hate mail here, because I know that many of our listeners are huge Doctor Who fans, and I don't want to take that away from anybody, because Doctor Who is wonderful. I just want to ask the question of, did you ever yourself think that, you know, what would really make my life complete would be if someone would take Doctor Who and Star Trek The Next Generation and mash them together, then the world would be right.
Right. I certainly never thought that. I mean, we've had plenty of Next Gen episodes with bizarre guest stars. Basically Jason Bourne showed up in The Hunted.
We had Max Headroom in A Matter of Time.
Exactly. We have Fat Romulan in The Defector. And Q shows up from time to time. So, you know, the difference between Q and Doctor Who is not actually that great. They're kind of similar. So this isn't beyond the pale, beyond the realm of possibility. But no, it's nothing that I ever conceived of. I was actually just talking with somebody last night about Doctor Who, and I was explaining to her how there's sort of a split between people who watch Doctor Who and people who watch Battlestar Galactica. And I'm definitely on the Galactica side of things. I like my sci-fi serious, and I like my special effects good. So I tend to stay away from Doctor Who for the most part, as much as people are trying to get me into it. So a Battlestar Galactica Star Trek crossover? Sure, I'm all for it.
So say we all.
But Doctor Who, I just, really, another of these things that just boggles the mind.
Are you going to start the internet debate of who would win in a battle, the Enterprise D or the Battlestar Galactica?
Wow, that's a tough one. Well, the Galactica doesn't have shields, but Galactica does have nukes. And we've seen that sometimes primitive weapons do a lot to the Enterprise, things that they're not quite prepared for.
They do. I mean, now Kirk was very concerned about, you know, old-style nuclear weapons.
Exactly.
And TOS. But I think Picard would probably kind of laugh it off. Like, lasers. Yeah. Well, right. And nukes. Yeah. Right.
here's the thing, though. Galactica can launch squadrons of Vipers. And at least the Enterprise-D pretty much just has Worf there pushing buttons. And I'd like to see Worf try to take on a squadron of seasoned Viper pilots in Mark 1s and Mark 6s and try to take them down. I don't think it's going to happen. And then you got Raptors with nukes. You've got all sorts of things. And later on, you've got, like, you could have, like, a Silent Centurion strike force go and board. And then Worf would have to go down and take care of that, too. And how could he shoot phasers and battle Centurions in hand-to-hand combat at the same time? I don't think the D stands a chance.
So say we all.
Well, but don't you think they can just tech the tech and get out of it?
It's possible, Captain. If we push the matter stream through the transwarp portal and then vent some plasma into the flibbergabber, I think we might be able to do a barrel roll. And make it out of here.
But the problem is that the flibbergabber won't be delivered until next Tuesday. So, Greg, I think your plan is shot. Now, what I would love to see is all those Vipers coming in and like a fleet of shuttlecraft going out to fight them.
That would be hilarious. It'd be that like that episode where the Cylons are coming in and then Athena stops them and they just sort of are dead in space and the Vipers just like slaughter all of them brutally. And it's just like 5 minutes of like explosions and blood, only just with shuttlecraft. That'd be a beautiful thing.
That would be beautiful. So let's see. Now, I think we were talking about the Doctor Who comic crossover, weren't we?
So I believe this is the, I forget which Doctor this is as far as the number system. But this is starting with season 5 of the new series. They had Matt Smith. So this appears to be the Matt Smith Doctor Who. And the Enterprise D, so this isn't the Enterprise E, so it falls somewhere in the first, you know, or in the 7 seasons. I'm assuming it could be an 8th season episode. I'm not entirely sure.
But my head is spinning right now.
And there's something about the Borg teaming with the Cybermen, and I don't know who the Cybermen are, but it sounds dumb. Nothing, very dumb, not like the Borg, which are fantastic. And make much more sense.
Well, I think the Borg and the Cybermen, aren't they the same thing, just with a different name, maybe? I mean,
it's very
the Borg
possible.
Are Cybermen. Well,
they are.
Cybermen and Cyberwomen. and Cyberdogs, of course, because you have four of those there.
It's very possible. So I guess the Cybermen and the Borg team up, and so Doctor Who and Picard have to team up. I don't know.
Yes. All right. Well, anyway, this is coming out in May. If anyone is interested in reading it, I will probably read it just to find out what it's like. And it's going to be sell for $3.99, 32 pages as usual. And you can get it at your comic shops or in the IDW app for iOS. And
right.
I don't know if they have that for Android or not.
I'm more excited for this than I was for the Legion of Superheroes TOS crossover. That just, I never could get myself into that. But this actually has potential, at least. I will probably actually read this one.
What would you like to see when they move on to DS9 and they do a DS9 crossover? What's going to be good there?
Well, I mean, I guess it would just make sense you do DS9 Battlestar at that point. Trying to think of what other, you could do DS9 Stargate or DS9 Farscape. Those are both reasonable alternatives.
Oh, well, I'm going to wait for the Voyager Archie crossover series that's going to come out. That one's going to get my attention.
Enterprise and 30 Rock, I hear. That's going to be a good one.
Okay. Well, moving on in comics here, we do have a little bit more comic news. Now, IDW, they have unveiled their May Trek titles. And Greg, as we talked in the other side of the room, these announcements are always so far ahead of the actual releases. And then it feels like, because we get one issue per month, that it feels like these things never actually come out. We're always waiting and waiting for the next one to come out. So as we're waiting for the second part of Operation Annihilate, Operation Annihilate, yeah.
Right.
Whatever, to come out. And then the two-part first original material, the Vengeance Conspiracy, I believe it's called, correct?
The Vulcans. The Vulcan Supremacy, as I like to call it.
Yeah, right.
Sounds like a Robert Ludlum novel.
We now find out what's going to come after that. Now, I think we talked about before whether this was the Operation Annihilate was going to be the end of the retellings and the beginning of all new material leading up to the movie, or if they were going to retell again. Well, coming out in May, Star Trek Ongoing number 9 is going to start Return of the Archons. So we do have a retelling again.
Yeah, very good. Now, this is still a season 1 episode, right?
Yes, I believe that is correct. Yes. Yep.
Are they still going in order? I mean, it was...
Well, no, they've jumped around because...
They've jumped around?
Well, Operation Annihilate is actually the final episode of season 1. So
right. So now we're going back in time, at least as far as the original series is concerned. Although, who knows what the actual chronological order of the original series episodes are. It's not like Stardates made any logical sense back in the 60s. But at least they're not jumping forward into season 2 or season 3, or they're not doing any animated series episodes yet.
Right. There's no Cloud Minders yet because
right.
Uhura just wasn't going to let Spock get near Droxine this time. So we're not going to see that. But anyway, yeah, Return of the Archons. I'm trying to think now. Now, what does this mean? Because they do say, you know, the build up to the next movie continues in Star Trek Ongoing number 9, mm-hmm. Return of the Archons. And what does this mean for the movie? Now, my guess is that it means that Benedict Cumberbatch is going to be playing Landru.
That wouldn't make sense. But I I don't know. I think that the continues the build up is just a bit of marketing speech. It's like there is a movie coming out, and also you can read this comic that's going to have all these characters in it.
Yeah. But I don't know. I feel like that we will look back at all of these after we see the movie and we'll say, ah, there was a clue.
That's very possible, yeah.
I think they're just dropping very small clues here. I don't necessarily think that the movie story is going to have anything to do with Return of the Archons, but something's going to be... Maybe Kirk is going to go around like whipping people with these long sticks all over the ship when they do something wrong. It's kind of like an Abrams-verse version of the Agonizer.
Right. I'm not sure. The thing is, I'm still waiting for the next bit of Operation Annihilate, because this is actually the one that has Kirk's brother in it. So I'm wondering, what are they even going to do here? And then the whole Vulcan thing, it really fascinates me. And I have no idea, like where this comic is going.
Yeah.
It looks like
I am more looking forward to the Vengeance Conspiracy or whatever. Now you got me confused on the title, what it's called, but I am more looking forward to that one just because I have a feeling that that really is going to set the stage next movie a bit. So I'm looking forward to that one. All right, but that's what's coming up next in terms of ongoing. And then we also have Star Trek Classics Volume 3 Encounters with the Unknown coming out. And this is four different Voyager stories that have been out before. One called False Colors, Avalon Rising, Elite Force, and Planet Killer, which really should have an exclamation point after it. And I think they really missed an opportunity there by not doing
Planet that. Killer. I think most Voyager episodes should have had an exclamation mark after it.
Eye of the Needle!
Ex post facto!
End game. Yeah, Voyager.
Scorpion.
Would have been so much more exciting if every episode had an exclamation point.
Maybe they can do that.
Especially
for the next series.
The story about Janeway back on Earth, 1159.
Exactly. Now you're getting it.
That's right. But it's good to see, at any rate, IDW releasing something in comics that's not simply the Abramsverse. I think a lot of fans. I read I generally don't read comic threads very often because they tend to digress into people just complaining. But they did mention on the IDW thread about ongoing that, yeah, it looks like pretty much everything now is going to be Abramsverse. Why can't we continue? You have the license to 5 different series within the franchise, not counting TAS, of course. Why don't you pursue them all instead of just making everything alternate universe? So, but there is going to be a little bit here, although this is not new material for Voyager fans. You'll be able to get your hands on this 204-page omnibus for $21.99. That's Encounters with the Unknown.
Very cool.
Well, Greg, moving on to our next story here. Now, you have that plush Enterprise that's been flying around your room there.
Yes,
but I know you've had it on autopilot now for a couple of weeks. And what it really needs is a crew. And luckily, coming up, it's not going to be until next year. So you've got to keep that autopilot going for a little while. But Hasbro has a line of Creo bricks and Creon figures coming out to allow you to put a crew onto your ship.
And now, to be entirely honest, I don't know what Creo bricks are. Is this like Lego?
A little bit different. Now, I will say I don't personally have any Creo bricks, but I do have the Bear bricks, which are very popular in Japan, which are made by Kubro. And I believe my understanding is that the Hasbro Creo line is very similar to that. And they are just what are they like? I'm going to say 2.5-3 inch tall, something like that. Little figures, you know, basically molded plastic. Now the bear bricks actually look like bears. And I have Kirk, Spock, and Uhura, who were released for the last movie in 2009.
Very cute.
They have little bear ears on them there, but they otherwise have the Starfleet uniforms on.
Right.
These figures don't look like bears. They're made to look more like actual characters, but in a cartoonish way.
Right. Yeah. They appear to just be little toys like that, but they work in like larger sets. Like you build stuff, environments for them to play in. I guess you can maybe even build like ships. You might be able to build a bridge with these. That's the sense I get. It's been so long since I've perused a toy aisle that this has eluded me. When are these actually coming out?
They're coming out in support of the next movie, they say in the press release.
Oh, I see.
Now the next movie comes out May 17th of 2013, and these I believe will be appearing sometime in the spring. So I don't know exactly. I'm going to just say like February, March, maybe of 2013, something
okay.
in that range.
Okay, so by April or so, you should be able to build your model replica of the Tribble King and his cohorts.
Yes, okay. That's right. The Tribble King is going to be one of those special figures where you know you have to buy the others and you cut out the little proofs of purchase and then you send those in and then they will send you the Tribble King. Yes.
Nice.
It's like when I was a kid when Empire Strikes Back came out and I used to have every Star Wars action figure and to get Yoda, you actually had to do that. You had to to cut out little proofs of purchases and you sent them in and you got back the Yoda with the little like a felt jacket on and the little snake around his neck. Yep.
That's incredible.
It's going to be like that.
This is showing that they're a little bit better at getting toys out. I don't remember personally, but back when the original Star Wars film came out, they didn't even have toys ready for that Christmas. What you could do is buy your kid an empty box that said, you will have toys shipped to you in the next couple months. Which, that's got to be the worst Christmas gift ever. Woo! It's an empty box with pictures of toys that are coming. And when you're a kid and you just don't have a sense of time at all, it just means you don't have toys right now.
Greg, is there something that happened to you that you want to share with us here?
Well, no, but this is very similar, actually, to the fact that we just don't have a new Star Trek film. I feel like I've been given an empty Star Trek film box, and it'll be shipped to me sometime next year. We have all this news coming out, but no actual film in our hands, and it's getting quite distressing.
Yes, it is. It is. So, well, speaking of that...
Nice.
All right, Greg. Well, it looks like there's a lot of suing going on apparently in the world of Star Trek these days.
Yes, indeed. This is like a story out of Entourage. I don't know if that's a show you watch, but
yeah, I do.
Okay. Yeah. Well, this is definitely straight out of it, and it feeds exactly into what I've been saying about Chris Pine
exactly yes.
for weeks and weeks now. Apparently, so you know, he came. Yes.
I meant to tell you, Greg, that I know you've been working really hard on the last few shows to try to start this rumor that Chris Pine is difficult to work with.
Right.
I think maybe I owe you an apology
exactly. Because, okay, so here's the story, basically, that, I mean, if our listeners haven't heard it, Chris Pine, you know, was this young actor, and he just didn't have that many roles. So he signed with one of these, you know, smaller agencies to help him get roles. And he got, you know, Princess Diaries 2, he got a couple other stuff. And he got Star Trek. And then what basically happened is Star Trek happened. And he became hot stuff. And basically in, I believe it was 2011, he just up and dropped the agency. And apparently he didn't even call them. He just stopped answering their phone calls, which, with knowing what I know about Chris Pine, that's a pretty normal occurrence. He just, you know, leaves you high and dry. And they're basically suing him because... They feel that he abandoned them and left them high and dry, and they were going to be making him money, and he was going to be making them money.
Yeah. So Greg, again, I have to ask, is there something that happened to you that you want to share with us?
Chris Pine, to be clear, for any, you know, legal things that may be going on, Chris Pine has done nothing personally to me, and I have done nothing personally to Chris Pine. I'm speaking mainly about industry rumors, things I've heard,
things I know
from highly placed sources deep within the Star Trek production that simply tell me that Chris Pine is a jerk, and if you smile at him, he will punch you in the face. I'm not saying I know this for certain. I'm just saying that I have been told this, and it has been confirmed by multiple people.
No, I think what you're talking about there, Greg, is this little bit from People Magazine's Chris Pine Fun Facts, which is that on the first day of shooting Star Trek 2009, he accidentally broke a stuntman's nose. Is that what you're saying?
Accidentally.
As far as him punching? Yes.
Accidentally. Let's put this in quotation marks. Quote, accidentally. I don't know, Chris Jones, not Chris Pine. Chris, when was the last time?
I thought it was Dan today.
Dan, I'm sorry, Dan. Chris, when was the last time you broke someone's nose accidentally?
Well, I did hit myself in the nose yesterday, pulling very hard on a headrest in our car.
Okay, but did
but
you...
But it only resulted in a sneezing attack.
There you go. You didn't send a stuntman to the emergency room.
No,
right.
Because I had given the stuntman the day off. Normally, it's his job to adjust the headrest.
But. Yes. So basically, there's now a suit where the agency SDB Partners is suing him, I suppose, for a breach of contract and just, you know, in general, not being a very nice guy. I guess there's some interesting stuff that's coming out of this where we know that Chris Pine is now, or he's been signed for 3 films. And we actually know his salary for the Star Trek films.
I was actually surprised at this. I thought that I guess we have to remember that most of these actors, that they signed on for the J.J. Abrams Star Trek were relatively unknown. Right. You know, they're not like big stars at the time. And I was kind of surprised at these figures here. I thought they were really quite low considering what the studio can make off of these Star Trek films.
Yeah, they're low, but when you consider it's an ensemble cast, and when you consider that, yes, all of them are unknowns, but you can see, well, I guess what we have, we don't know his salary for the first film, but we know for the second film it's $1.5 million plus up to $500,000 with back end compensation, you know, if it's a hit,
mm-hmm.
and then for the third film, if it happens, $3 million plus $500,000 in back end.
Yeah,
so that's pretty good.
But I really expect that number for the third movie in particular to be renegotiated before the third movie
comes
out.
I mean, I don't know exactly how that works with renegotiating, but yeah, I heavily expect that. Also, because look at the other numbers that came out. He's basically been signed. They haven't put it into production, but he's been signed to do the next three Jack Ryan films. Now, this is like Hunt for Red October, Clear and Present Danger, all of those films that were Alec Baldwin, Ben Affleck. So he's doing those, and those are $4 million, $8 million, and $12 million. So that's considerably more, basically, is what he's getting for those. And I'd heavily expect him to be making a little bit more than $3 million for doing a Star Trek film, especially if they continue to be big hits.
If this next one makes the kind of money that the last one did,
yeah.
I would expect. Now, do you think that Winona Ryder made more money for the first movie than Chris Pine did?
That's very possible, which would be crazy considering most of her scenes were cut. But it's one of those things where it's just, you got to spend money to get the people who are names, and you don't have to spend that much for the new people.
Well, exactly. I mean, that's why in Enterprise, that's why Captain Archer has a Beagle and not a Jack Russell, because they wanted to have Eddie, but Eddie was just too expensive. You know, after Frasier, I mean, you just can't afford him anymore. So they had to go with whoever the Beagle is that plays Porthos. I think he's one of Snoopy's cousins, not mistaken.
Nice. Did you hear that the little Jack Russell Terrier from The Artist has been hired by Nintendo to be the new spokes dog for Nintendogs?
Oh my gosh. Oh gosh. Which Nintendogs has a spokes dog?
Has a spokes dog now. And this dog is the cutest dog. I'm really hoping they can find a way to work him into the next Star Trek film. I haven't heard any rumors. I'm not saying that Spock and Uhura aren't able to have a child and have to adopt a dog instead. I'm not saying that that's in the script already. I'm not saying that's been confirmed by multiple sources. But if that does happen to happen, oh, this dog from The Artist. Oh, so cute. So cute.
I thought we were under non-disclosure, Greg.
I'm saying that none of that has been specifically and absolutely confirmed to me personally. I'm just saying
your exclusive sources.
By my high place sources.
Yeah. I understand. Yeah, I hear you. Now, this just brings to mind to me now, does Nintendo Cats have a spokesperson either? Because, you know, they also have a collection of those.
That's true.
For DS and 3DS as well.
I'm trying to think of who would be good for that, but I'm trying to think of any cats that I would want to work with. And it's really hard. Most cats turn into big divas after they basically, after their first hit, they just become impossible to work with.
Yeah, pretty much. I don't know. Maybe Garfield.
Garfield's not doing much these days.
No. He's been out of work for a while, from what I hear. All right. Well, okay. So that's what's up with Chris Pine.
Yes.
And of course, as you continue to confuse our listeners with your insistence on starting a rumor that Chris Pine is difficult to work with and saying all these bad things about him, which makes me wonder if there's a little something going on behind the scenes there that we don't know about. But
I'm just saying. Oh, I did want to mention, too, that I hope our listeners are going to see this weekend This Means War, which stars Chris Pine, you know, young Kirk, and also Tom Hardy, who's young Picard. And I'm assuming that they're going after young Soren and stopping him from basically catching the young Nexus and destroying young Viridian 3.
Right. It's pretty easy here because, you know, the Nexus in its youth was both small and slow moving.
Yes.
And it's much easier to capture it now.
It's actually kind of cute.
The scene that I'm most looking forward to there, of course, is that when young Picard gets sucked into the young Nexus and he meets young Guinan from Rascals.
Perfect.
All right. So, Greg, moving on from Chris Pine, we also have a little bit of movie news here related to Zachary Quinto, who says that the Star Trek sequel is bigger and bolder.
Oh.
And also that apparently the actors collaborated with the writers.
I was confused. I thought Zachary Quinto was bigger and bolder.
Well, that's something that, again, we are not supposed to reveal about the next movie.
Right.
But that's what we hear.
But yes, Quinto said, you know, the movie is bigger and bolder. It's more dynamic. I think he said that they're going to change the paradigm. They're going to drill down, and they're really going to start tasking people and have some face time and one-on-one interaction and, you know, really hit these bullet points, hit them hard.
So basically he's approaching the next movie as if it's some sort of PowerPoint presentation. Is
yes.
that what you're saying?
What
a lot
I'm,
of
yes.
marketing talk in there and
I'm just
industry
saying,
jargon. Yes.
I'm just saying they've yeah. been having a lot of staff meetings at the latest Star Trek production. And Quinto seems to have taken some jargon away from it.
Apparently, so that's what it sounds like. All right. So that's the news for Zachary Quinto. There's not a lot of meat to this, but apparently he likes what he's seeing from the script, I guess is what I would say there. And I will say that if this is all true, and if he is talking about the movie being bigger and bolder, not just Spock himself being bigger and bolder, I'm glad to hear that because I have been reserving judgment personally on the Abrams verse until I see the second movie.
Yes.
I've kind of said, okay, look, I'll give you the first movie. Let everybody meet each other. That's fine. But from the second movie, I expect a deeper story. And
right.
so I do hope this is true.
Yeah, it's hard to judge anything from, you know, 2 hours of it. You know, 2 hours yeah. into Next Gen. What did we think about Next Gen? 2 hours into
yeah, right, exactly.
the original series, film series. I mean, what were we thinking, you know, after 2 hours of Robert Wise's motion picture?
Yeah.
So it's
well, exactly. That's a good yeah. point. I mean, after the motion picture, you had no clue that something like The Wrath of Khan
exactly.
might come along after that. So
right.
so again, you know, this one, Khan's Revenge, that's going to be coming out in 2013 is going to be the same type of thing.
Exactly. Now, so speaking now, of Khan Noonien Singh, Benedict Cumberbatch is also in this film, and I can't confirm or deny who he'll be playing, but speaking of Khan, and what does Chris Pine say about the guy who's playing Khan?
Well, see, here we go, Greg. We're ready to move on through news, and here comes Chris Pine trying to hog the spotlight again. He's butting back into news. Apparently, you know, after we talked to Quinto, he's like, I got to get back in there. I'm the captain, man. Apparently, Cumberbatch is really intense, man. He's intense
yeah.
on the set. He's talking about Cumberbatch's intensity.
Right. And this is, I mean, this is something that's true. I've been going back and watching a little bit of Sherlock. I've not watched the whole thing. Please don't spoil anything. I don't want to know what happens at the end of the sixth episode.
Greg, they're only like 5 hours or something. You can't get through it by now.
No, it's, well, okay, so there's six episodes, but they're each 90 minutes. And
oh.
I think, yeah, so it's...
Those sneaky Brits.
It's crazy. Like, this isn't TV. What are you doing? You know. But I'm working on actually getting to it, and I'm trying to avoid spoilers. But Cumberbatch himself is quite intense. He has a demeanor to him. As Sherlock, he is fantastic, and I can't wait to see what he does with his character in the new film. And it's good to hear... You know, actors say fluff all the time. You know, this is what you do in Hollywood, but you can still get something out of the type of fluff that they're saying. And the fact that he wants to talk about the way he handles himself and his intensity and his vocal quality and the fact that he's a trained actor makes me really feel like he's bringing something special to this role. I think for all the things I love about this first Star Trek film, the villain was not really one of them. Nero was kind of blah. He was just kind of there. Did you feel the same way, Dan?
Oh, well, Mike, you know, I thought Nero was okay, but yeah, he was not a strong villain like yeah. Khan, for example. He served his purpose in the story, but I don't know. He was just kind of there to set up an excuse for Prime Spock and alternate universe Spock to meet each other,
right?
And to change history. Yeah. So, but so, I mean, you can say that you weren't that impressed with him, but it doesn't explain why you have your head tattooed like him.
That's true. I did go do that last night, and I'm not sure what I was thinking. I was a little drunk. I did go see Safe House, and then I had a few more drinks and a few more drinks, and I like my facial tattoos, though. I think they're distinctive.
Yeah. Yeah. I like how you're just, you know, outdoing Chakotay there. His looks like, you know, it's like a kiddie stuff, basically.
Right. Exactly.
Compared to what you've done. So it's pretty nice. But you know, look at this picture that I put here in the show notes of Cumberbatch. Now, don't you think that he would make a really nice, intense Landru that comes back to life? It's like Landru incarnate. And I think it could work.
I think Cumberbatch could do anything. You know, he's playing Smaug the Dragon, for goodness sakes. I think he could do pretty much anything he wanted. So I'm very excited to see this next Star Trek film focusing more on the villain. I think the Star Trek films, I think films in general that focus on the villains are good things. It's not always great to simply focus on the good guys figuring out the problems. As I think we're going to actually talk about in our feature, just watching people figure out the techno babble is not always the most striking TV or film. So to have a villain there who's somebody that we really have to match up against and who sort of turns us on our head and makes us think about, you know, who we are. Yeah, that's drama.
All right. Well, that part sounds good. Now, one other little bit we have here about the movie is apparently Bruce Greenwood is content with Pike's role in the Star Trek sequel. And as good as all that sounds that you just said there about Cumberbatch and his villain, the Triple King or Landru, or, you know, the Glamour Prince or whatever it's going to be. Apparently, Bruce is just, he's kind of content, you know, it's like, well, I feel all right about what I'm doing here.
Yeah, I was expecting, you know, over the moon. I was expecting, you know.
Bruce Greenwood is over the moon with
exactly.
A Pike's role.
Right. So I think we can assume that the Pike Janice Rand wedding scene is off. They're not going to go in that direction for the second film. I think we can assume that Captain Pike probably won't be reassuming captain of the Enterprise and sort of pushing Kirk to the side.
That would have been a good way to go. Kirk's like his understudy for the next movie.
Oh, that would have been great. And that would have shut up all the people who were detracting. You know, Kirk can't be captain so soon. The new film comes on. It's like, oh, no, we're just kidding. We're just kidding.
Kirk's... Yeah, he wasn't really captain. We were just we were just screwing with him, you know.
You know, it was...
And you too.
Right. Yeah, we cut back directly after the scene where he's given the captaincy. And basically Ashton Kutcher comes out and is like, you've been punked. You are going to be working in engineering.
And then everyone cracks up on the bridge and we've got our classic TOS episode ending. Simon Pegg coughing up a lung back there by the elevator doors.
This is exciting. He's not actually the captain. He's actually still an ensign. That's exciting.
Oh, man. It's too bad we're the only ones that got the special Latinum Edition DVD release of Star Trek 2009 and got to see that.
Yes, and it's going to be a big surprise when Khan's Revenge premieres and all this is revealed. But no, I think we can probably assume that Greenwood's Pike has more of a cameo role, you know. More like he was at the end where he's just sort of there. Maybe he pushes Kirk on. I mean, he is an important character. I mean, he's sort of Kirk's father figure. So I hope he has more to do than just wave as they fly off.
Yeah. That is true. That's what I was going to say. That is true. In this alternate universe, he is kind of like a father figure for Kirk. But I was going to say, what if his only thing in the movie is at the beginning of the movie, they're having a staff meeting at Starfleet Command, and then everyone leaves to go fly up to the Enterprise, and Pike just kind of rolls out in his wheelchair and waves bye to them, and that's all we see.
So that would be too
bad. That's
why
he's content with it. You know, I'm in it, but kind of yet. And then right. at the end, he shows they come back and he like greets them as they
welcome
arrive
back.
Home. That's it. Or maybe he'll just appear on a view screen. You know, he'll pop up.
I was thinking,
Admiral Pike.
Right. I was thinking they could do like the scene from, was it Nemesis, where Janeway appears?
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, right. So they could have Pike appear and he can sort of recap all of the comic storylines. He's like,
yes,
Captain Kirk, you fought the creatures on that one planet and went to the edge of the universe and also dealt with something with the Vulcans and amoebas.
And space amoebas.
And all of that. What are you possibly going to do next?
You get
I'm so
all
glad
the
I'm here.
Exciting missions. Yes. Exactly. All right. Well, that's most of what we have in the movie news today. Although, Greg, I did hear about one other story. apparently, Zachary Quinto prepared a big chili dinner for everybody on the set for the cast and crew. Did you hear about that?
I did hear about this. The cast and crew was very excited. There's going to be a chilly night for the whole crew because they've gotten through a couple weeks of shooting. And then what happened next, Chris?
Well, everyone was excited about it until they found out that it was actually the special Vulcan Plomeek chili. And then they said it just wasn't quite as tasty as they were hoping for. They prefer, you know, like three alarm chili.
Right.
This one is a little rough. You know, the Plomeek root sometimes kind of hard to chew.
It can be. And I just imagine Chef Quinto off in the corner sort of dealing with it and trying to handle it. But it's getting to be too much. And,
it is.
You know, Uhura has to run up and sort of, you know, hug him and reassure him. It's not Zoe Saldana. Yeah. Uhura goes up and comforts Zachary Quinto.
Right, yeah. But before that happens, they start criticizing. Like Chris Pine was like, man, you know, this chili is just, it's so terrible. I hate this chili. And then Quinto runs up and like grabs his neck, starts trying to choke him. Gets out of control. And then finally, Quinto just rips the chef's hat off. And he says, I'm not fit to cook. And then that's when Uhura runs over and hugs him.
Right. Well, and there's that moment where his father comes. You know, this was the day that the Zachary Quinto's father was visiting the set. And he's just like, you know, he's just standing there. And he's like, you know, Zach, what have you become? And that's the moment where it really hit Zach that,
yeah.
You know, he's taking his chef duties too far and he's forgetting what it means to be an actor, to control yeah. his emotions.
It's just a bowl of soup, man.
Just a bowl of soup. You know, sometimes the needs of the crew outweigh the needs of the one.
When DS9 premiered, the writers wasted no time in getting one of the next generation's favorite characters, Q, onto the show. And today we're going to talk about Q and that episode, Q-less. And of course, Greg is with me. And joining us today, we also have the Hoodies, also known as Tristan Riddell and Brian Finifter. Hi, guys.
Hey, welcome. How you doing?
Hey, everyone.
All right. Thanks for joining us. Now, of course, so everyone knows, the Hoodies. Greg and I decided to dress up for the show today, and Tristan, at least you have a hood on your sweatshirt there, thus you're now known as the Hoodies.
Well, once you guys start paying me more, I might put on a suit.
We're
That's
working
the thing.
On that.
We have but to start paying them more,
yeah,
and then
you know,
they'll dress up.
You haven't even paid me enough to wear pants, so you know, you're going to have to pay me a little bit to keep me from tilting the webcam down so you can see that effect.
That's good.
See, this is like we were talking about in the news with Chris Pine's contract negotiation. I think Brian and Chris have been talking a little bit about how to start screwing over your production company.
Wait, they have to renegotiate Chris Pine's... Don't these days when you sign on to do a franchise, don't you sign the initial contract for like 27 movies or something.
Like, you can still pull out. Yeah. No contract in Hollywood is solid.
Yeah, I guess so.
All right. Well, Q, everyone. first of all, yeah. I would assume that you liked Q on The Next Generation. How did you feel about Q showing up on Deep Space Nine?
It was weird remembering that Q was on this show. Like, I was just looking over Q episodes, wanting to do a Q episode. And I was like, oh, yeah, he did DS9, didn't he? And he just sort of pops up and does his Q thing. But I don't know. I think we're going to talk about it a little bit. I don't know how well he meshes with the DS9 mechanic. And I guess in a way that's good. And it sort of lets us explore in what ways DS9 is different from Next Gen. What did you guys think? Like, Brian?
Yeah, well, I definitely don't think this episode works at all. I mean, this is the sixth episode of the show total. You know, it's very early in the first season. And I think it's absolutely one of those cases where you're doing a new show that's grown out of a previous show, and you're like, you still don't have a clue as what to do. So like, well, they like this thing from the old show, so let's do that. It's like this Q-less is the naked now version of, you know, for DS9.
Right.
Yeah. You know, they haven't figured out what DS9 is yet as a separate thing from Next Generation. So like, well, we'll get the guy that everybody likes and we'll do him. And it doesn't work. And I did remember that this episode existed. I didn't remember that it was this early. And rewatching it this morning, I realized that I remember about 5 seconds from this episode, and the rest of it was a complete and utter blank. Right. I remember the one line after Sisko hits Q, and Q goes, "You hit me, Picard never hit me." And Sisko says, "Well, that's, I'm not Picard." Like, that is the single solitary moment that I had any recollection of. And the rest of it was a complete blank space.
But, and Avery Brooks looks so proud when he says that, like, "I'm not Picard.
Yeah,
I'm a totally new captain." And you can tell because I'm saying it.
As we talked about before,
that's pretty much
Avery
a microcosm of the episode.
But right. Yeah. And it's like, that's a great moment. And if there's any redeeming quality to this episode, then it's almost like when you run an experiment and you don't get the answer you expect, it's not a failure, because even if you get the negative answer, it still told you something new, and that's still valuable.
Right.
If I think, the redeeming quality of this episode might be that it's like, well, you tried to do this thing and Deep Space Nine is definitely not this thing, so we know not to do this anymore. So I think that's this episode in a nutshell.
Well, what about you, Tristan?
Well, I felt like all the parts were well crafted, but it's like you make the gears in a watch solid gold, but you don't make them, fit together. I felt like all the performances were done really well. I liked Avery Brooks in it. I like Q. I like Vosh. I like Quark. I thought Julian, was quite good, even though he was a horn dog for the entire episode. It was all good. I mean, I felt like they were kind of finding their characters as they were going on, but it just didn't fit together. And like Brian said, I mean, it was an experiment, and it was a good experiment because you found a new way of what not to do.
Right.
And it took DS9 a season or two to realize that it's not TNG. It doesn't have to be a TNG, and the followers will come.
Right.
And
definitely did feel like a TNG story. You know, as I've talked about before, how the first couple people who don't like DS9, I remind them, well, you need to watch from, say, third season onward, because the first two seasons are not indicative of the show. And I liked seeing Vosh again, and I was okay with Q there, but it felt like what I would have liked to have seen. I was thinking about when I was watching it again, at the beginning of the episode, when they walk away from the ship and Q kind of turns around, and the music comes up, it's like, oh, there's Q there. Wouldn't the story have been better if we didn't see Q until he shows up in Vosh's quarters? I mean, if you've watched The Next Generation and Vosh says, well, a friend dropped me off, that should be enough for you.
Right.
To say, I bet Q's behind this, but let's see how it plays out. So that,
well, like the original pitch of this show didn't even involve Q. They just were going to say, let's bring Vosh on the show and see how she works with this cast. But they were so desperate to have it's sort of like they talk about the poster for Generations, where you have like the two Enterprises fighting each other.
Yeah.
It's such a good poster Now let's just write a script that works. And they could get the script. But it's such a good teaser end to have Q show up on DS9. Yeah. Like, that sounds like a great idea.
But it's
true. Yeah, to the have the, you know, him turn around and do the dolly in, and the music swells, and just it builds that moment. And then you cut to the first commercial break. Like,
it's perfect.
That's a very solid way of, you know, grinding out television, but not necessarily good television.
But as you watch the episode go on, you're thinking the whole time that, like, this episode does not need Q. The story
doesn't actually
have anything to do with him. I mean, he's not even responsible for what's going on in any way.
Yeah. I mean, he's comedic relief.
You know, he neither creates the situation that they have to respond to, nor does he, you know, solve it in any way at the end.
He's just there.
He's just, he's there to be like, hey, you like the other thing, right? With the other thing with the guy, he's funny. It's right. It was a very cheap, I think the watch analogy is a great one. It's like, these are great gears. These are great pieces of a thing, but they don't belong together. They don't fit, and they don't actually turn each other. And they don't work together.
And problem that we could actually run into is if we didn't introduce Q until later on, we'd see the title right in the corner of the screen.
Q-less.
Oh, it says Q in it.
Well, but the title is Q-less. There is no Q in this story.
Right.
Gotcha. Yeah. He's here after all.
Has there ever been a Q episode where the teaser didn't end with him, like, as the big reveal before the opening credit sequence?
I don't remember. Was Tapestry? Well, did it show?
Farpoint doesn't end with a Q at the end of the teaser, right? It doesn't even. Does he show?
Farpoint doesn't even have a teaser. It just doesn't. It just go into the credits because it's.
I guess that's probably true.
That's true. That's true.
But that's an exception too. Farpoint would be a special case anyway.
Well, All Good Things doesn't have Q at the end of the teaser, but
okay, there you go.
But most of the ones in the middle, where it's like, this is a Q episode,
It's very much just trying to pull you in, like, you like John DeLancey, you want to watch this episode, and it's just, I'm trying to remember how long it took Voyager to bring Q in. They were kind of resistant to it, right? It took them a few seasons.
Yeah, I think the reason why they were resistant to it is because of this episode.
Yeah, wouldn't surprise
me. It was very clear that Avery Brooks and John DeLancey had zero chemistry. They did not have the give and take. They didn't have the diplomatic or intelligence battle or repartee that Patrick Stewart and John DeLancey had. I mean, I believe that Avery Brooks has that capability, but I don't know if Sisko does.
Interesting.
Right.
I don't know if Avery Brooks has that quality personally, but
you and I are complete disagreement about Avery Brooks.
Have you seen The Captain?
Have you seen Captains? Yeah.
I loved how freaking strange he was about how he if you listen, he never actually answered any questions.
Yes, exactly.
And it was fantastic.
That's very true.
He's like, keep going. Keep going.
Right. And Shatner was just feeding him stuff. I'd rather see Shatner show up on DS9, I think, than Q. But I guess I was going to ask a question. Do you think there's another character that maybe they could have matched Q up against? Like, knowing the whole series of DS9 and knowing these characters as well, is there a matchup where he could have come on and talked with somebody and it actually would have worked?
You mean like Morn, maybe?
Yeah, like maybe if he talked with Morn and sort of bounced some philosophical ideas off of him.
Actually, I think Quark.
I think Garak would be fun.
Quark or Garak would have been really interesting.
There you go.
Kira, maybe Quark would have been interesting. Anybody that doesn't take Q's crap would be interesting. But I think the way in which Quark would have been, you know, just like maybe would have schemed or done whatever, you know, but. Just the way I think Quark would have approached a situation like that might be interesting. But Garak's also an interesting one as well.
No, I liked what you said about Quark, though, because think about the great antithesis to Picard. It's not Sisko. It's Quark.
Yeah.
It is absolutely Quark because he, like, you know, Picard is all about defending the human race and how we've evolved and how we don't you know, wear silly costumes or obsess over money. And what does Quark do? He wears silly costumes and obsesses over money.
Right.
And he not only lives those things, he embraces it. And so I think that would be an interesting, you know, play on the different opposite side of the spectrum.
And that would actually be really interesting if it changed Q's approach, you know, and it really just showed Q as an antagonist for the sake of being an antagonist. You know, we've obviously seen him interact in this specific way, challenging Picard and, you know, what Picard believes in. And now he, you know, comes up against this character who's the complete and utter opposite of Picard. And then, you know, we see Q just do a 180 for the sole purpose of just proving to be an antagonist. And just right. like, he's one of those, he's like, I'm just going to mess with you to mess with you and push your buttons because I find it funny. And, but just to see that complete, like, two sides of the coin, that would have been interesting to see, I think. But, sadly, we didn't get it.
Greg, what did you... I'm sorry, I guess we kind of diverted from what you brought up about Q being on Voyager. How did you feel Janeway did in comparison to Sisko with Q?
Yeah, so that was an interesting thing. I felt like they did better things with Q on Voyager. I thought that the... And maybe it was the female captain dynamic and that he always... I think he saw her as... I don't know. He saw Picard as someone who was... He was sort of fighting against, like, Picard was better than Q. Like, Picard could always win the argument. Whereas Janeway, I think Q saw as not someone he was trying to beat, but someone who was an equal to him. And he was always trying to do things like that. I mean, it was sort of the same way his relationship with Vash. I think they kind of took the Q Vash thing and made it Q Janeway.
Yeah, I could see
and
that.
And I seem to remember that working a lot better than this is working. I was going to ask you guys who have seen TNG, maybe Chris more than I have, what Q was doing on TNG at this point. Like, there was an episode that aired the same week or like the next week of TNG that had Q on it. Maybe yeah, Tapestry.
Yeah, we were talking about that in the other side of the room, right? And I had forgotten right. that they were that close together, but you were saying Tapestry was around this time. However close they are, Tapestry, you know, was kind of like a Christmas Carol kind of story for Picard, where Q is showing him, you know, what his life would have been like if he had made different decisions, if he had chosen not to get into the fight with the Nausicaan that ended up, you know, damaging his heart. He has
that's right.
Heart,
that's the episode.
You know? Yeah, the dynamic between Q and Picard, all the way from Encounter at Farpoint to the end of the series, there were some comical things in the middle, you know, like Cupid, for example, where he's just kind of playing, trying to harass the Enterprise crew, basically. But I think that the core of who Q is as a character against Picard is this kind of tug of war between, like you guys said, Picard's view that humanity has evolved and the world right. is a better place now. And Q is the commentary against humanity that, you know, hey, we haven't come as far as we think we have. We still have all these problems, except he's saying to Picard, you have all these problems. And yeah, in this episode on DS9, you didn't get any of that at all.
Yeah.
Well, and I even on Voyager, I think you didn't get that again either. On Voyager, it became
just
more of a...
Just to jump in real quick.
I'd have to disagree with you on that. Oh, go ahead.
Well, Greg is actually right. Tapestry aired the 15th of February, 1993, and Q-List aired about the week before, on the 7th of February, or 2 weeks. I guess that would be 2 weeks.
Sort of like a Valentine's Day Q special.
Yeah. For the John DeLancey fans.
That we're doing
fans.
It this week as well.
Right. So what were you going to say, Tristan?
Oh, I was going to say I was going to have to respectfully disagree with you, Chris, about Voyager and Q, because there was a really powerful episode, in my opinion, called Death Wish.
Well, now Death Wish is the exception. Yeah,
yeah,
great,
yeah. Totally. That dealt with the other Q, where, you know, Q comes in against Quinn, and he says to Janeway, "How can you call yourself an evolved human being if you're just going to let this person kill himself?"
Yeah,
you know, I mean,
no, I agree with you. That's criminal, very, very good episode of Star Trek there, and I was thinking more like when they do like the Q in the Grave, for example,
or Q2, where he wants to,
Oh, jeez.
Yeah.
Wait, no, nice. Q2 is the one where his son is actually
son
a little bit grown up.
Oh, yeah. And that's where he's actually played by John DeLance's actual kid, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
It was the episode before where it's what's her name? Susie Plankton.
Plankton.
She plays Q's girlfriend, and anytime I can see her on screen, I'm gonna tune in. So yeah. I'm probably a little bit biased, but I liked her for her
Susie better as a Vulcan or a Q or a Klingon?
Or an Andorian.
Or an Andorian.
That's right, she was an Andorian.
She did play
an
Andorian Enterprise, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I do like her as the Q, and it's probably just because she's just normal Susie. But she's actually good as all of them, especially the Vulcan.
Yeah.
She made a really good Vulcan.
Dr. Solar.
I'd have to say Kalar for me is my
Really?
Is my favorite.
Solar. Solar is the hottest thing of all time.
The hottest thing of all time.
Vulcan is a hot Vulcan. That's all there is
to it.
Well,
now, Brian, yeah, exactly. Let's just say now, if Susie Plaxton as Dr. Solar is the hottest thing of all time. Now, I thought that you said that Jennifer Hetrick as Vash was the most seductive woman in the universe.
Well, okay,
in
here's
the other
the
side
thing.
Of the room.
It's played in Next Generation with her character as well, but I mean, it's kind of cranked up to 11 here on this episode. This is like this idea that she's this irresistible woman to every guy ever, and I just like it just seems like a casting thing. Like, that's. I'm sure the actress is a lovely. I don't remember her name. I guess you just said her name, but
Jennifer Hetrick. Yeah,
I'm sure she's a lovely person, and she has all sorts of wonderful things and credit cards and whatnot. But I don't see it. And even as a kid, I never saw, even when you're a kid before you actually hit adolescence and you have those feelings, you know, you're like, no, I like this one, but I don't get this one.
I would say she's very 90s beautiful, but I think I thought she was a very beautiful, beautiful woman. I totally bought into that aspect of the episode. I don't know.
It's not just her physical looks. I mean, it's also this quality, you know, it's like in movies or television, it's a character kind of stock character called the Manic Pixie Dream Girl, you know, like. Ramona Flowers and Scott Pilgrim is, or Zoe Deschanel in 500 Days of Summer, they're the, you know, quote unquote manic.
Natalie Portman
girl.
In Garden State.
Yeah, exactly. And like, it's this irresistible concept for guys like us, pretty much. Like, this kind of, I know for me, okay, I won't speak for you guys, but I know for me, it's like, that's absolutely true. Just the,
I know
one
at least
that
two
will
of
challenge
them in
you
Seattle
and
right
not take
now.
Your shit and, you know, just, you know, it's constantly a challenge. And I get, like, on paper, that's very clearly what she's supposed to be as a character. But I just, there's something about her portrayal that doesn't come across. I'm like, why is anybody putting
you
up
have
with
to,
this? True? And that's too harsh by half. But that's the basics of it.
I would point out that the three main people who are attracted to her in the episode. Well, you have Picard, but Picard's not in this, so ignoring that. You've got Julian, who's still. A complete douche.
Well, he's attracted to everything on the station at this point.
Chris is right.
And so really count him out. And then you've got Q, who's like totally self-obsessed, and who knows why he's in love with her, but it's, you know, it's been 2 years. He fell in love with her. And then you've got Quark, who's just in love with her because she's got stuff that he wants to make money off of. So they all kind of have reasons that make more sense than just that she is the most beautiful thing in the galaxy.
I think Q, it was because she turned him down. And,
exactly.
And that's probably never happened to him before. And so that's why he was so attracted to Janeway as well, because Janeway just kept saying no and no. And you're totally right about Quark. I mean, he likes powerful women. I mean, he doesn't go towards the Ferengi type females that are submissive and supposed to be back at home. He likes the powerful ones, the ones that, you know, stroke his lobes for profit. And, and I feel like, with Picard, even though he wasn't in this episode, I really liked Vash, growing up, mainly because my dad really liked her. And so I had to really like her. And I liked that
House
she
rule.
Was age appropriate for Patrick Stewart.
Mm-hmm.
And like, well, I guess somewhat age appropriate at that time.
As opposed
and
to like,
I could see
Jensen
them together.
Was, like, you know, 19.
Yes, exactly.
At the time of her.
Well, that was awesome just because she was Famke Janssen. But
I totally get Famke Janssen. Like, you tell me that, like, every guy in the galaxy will do anything to get her. Totally buy it. Anyway.
Especially if she's shipped in an egg crate.
If you're into that sort of thing, I mean, whatever floats your boats.
I like shipping.
I have a logistics fetish. Okay, there, I said it.
Wow.
I just,
so you guys are really into the whole River Tam in the Firefly pilot.
You know, there's a whole section of the internet. I can send you links if you want, but trust me, you don't want to
the
see
the seedy underbelly of the of the internet,
of the logistics fetish community. We're a tight knit group.
That's a gateway to stationary, though.
So what's next on our agenda, Chris?
Well, he said segueing as smoothly as he possibly could manage.
Yes, smooth segue here. Well, actually, we do have a segue here. As we talk about Vash and Quark, who represent, you know, like the core of capitalist thinking. And it's something we see in Star Trek, especially in the TNG era Star Trek, the idea that there is no money and there's apparently no, I don't know what kind of economic system there really is. I mean, there's, when you get out around Bajor, you feel like you're kind of on the outskirts of the Federation, because that's actually not Federation space. Obviously, people use Latinum to pay for things, and there's something
going on. It's the Federation Old West.
Yes, the Federation Old West. But
Frontier.
As you know, there's the whole buzz around the internet all the time about how Star Trek in the future, the Federation is a communist regime that's designed to hold everybody down. And you know, I have to admit there are many aspects of the Federation that would be considered socialist. And I think there's a lot of confusion amongst Americans, especially, that they use socialism and communism interchangeably, which is not an accurate way to do it. But at any rate, you know, it's a mystery in terms of how the Federation really operates, I think. But the point in this episode, though, is that they kind of comment on this several times, both through Q and through Odo. They make comments about capitalism. And, you know, Odo goes into this whole thing about, it felt really disjointed. You know, I think Odo turned into a really good character that I really like. But at the beginning, Odo, he just kind of spouts commentary at certain moments. And
yeah,
Quark comes into his office, and then Odo goes into the speech about how you, actually kind of true, he says you spend your whole lives trying to accumulate wealth, and then you die, and then your relatives sell everything, and then they start the cycle over again, which I was thinking, yeah, that is kind of true, you know, when you die, and then the family fights over who gets the chest of drawers, and then they...
Yeah,
right. You know, sell and off and the doll collection, but
you pick out the family heirlooms, and then you sell everything else, and then you move on, and eventually you die, and your kids pick out the same family heirlooms. Again,
yeah,
and
but why is it coming out of Odo? I think.
Well, that's the thing. Yeah, why is it coming out of Odo?
Yeah,
because Odo is the outsider.
He didn't have anything else
in
to
this
do.
Case.
I think this is a good example of early. Like, you can tell that this stuff is on the writer's mind, that this is the point of view that they have, and they haven't quite figured out how they want to express it about this kind of like skeptical, you know, take this skeptical point of view on the whole utopian, you know, Federation, Star Trek utopian idea.
Right. Yeah.
And it's like, this is what they're thinking. And they were thinking this when they were writing the show Bible, but they haven't figured out the angle of attack yet. So it's like, it starts to crop up as a line here and a section of a scene here, and then eventually it'll, you know, blossom into, you know, actual stories. But this is the very first probably hints of that, of what will come.
Yeah. So, I mean, is that what this episode is about? I kind of want to get to that, especially as we near the end. But I'm just wondering, like, because it seems like the A story in this episode leads to the fact that this object that everyone loves and everyone is willing to spend so much money on, it's unattainable. It's something that no one can even have.
Well,
and
it's
the
not
fact
only
that people
that,
are fighting over it and bidding on it.
Yeah. Not only
not
that,
possessible.
But it's the thing that's going to destroy you as well.
Right. Exactly. And it feels like a metaphor. And I don't know if they put that much thought into it, but it feels like in the end
that
it just feels like, okay, so this is unattainable, and it was just, this whole thing is useless, and it almost points towards the fact that what Vash does is silly if it's done for profit, that she should be doing this for the,
for science.
I don't know, the scientific reasons
it
and not for
the
profit.
It belongs in a museum.
Right, exactly. Kind of she's sentiment. And she totally is so space Indiana Jones. Yeah. I thought that as a kid too.
Well, yeah, she's space she Indiana that. Jones that's trying to be space Tomb Raider, but doesn't have the heart to be space Tomb Raider. And that, you know, that that comes up in the scene where she's actually at the auction and she's describing the historical context of it. And Quark's mm-hmm. like, what the hell are you doing? Just sell it.
And just, right.
You know, I think that's the reason why the writers kind of get into this mode, because the producers are like, let's do a Vash episode. And they're like, okay. And then they look at Vash and they see this person who has rejected Federation society. They've rejected Earth society. Mm-hmm. And so they're like, okay, well, if all of these Starfleet officers love the Federation and they love paradise, and then Vash gets introduced, who's human, you know, we can accept it as if when we see a Ferengi or when we see a Romulan or something like that. But when we see a human who wants to attain goods for profit,
yeah.
It kind of messes with the whole utopian outlook. I mean, I often use I use Vash as an example whenever somebody, you know, brings up, well, you know, how does the Federation utopia work? Do all of us have to follow this way of life? And I said, well, no, because you can just leave, because you know interstellar travel exists. And Vash is a great example of how not everyone wants that kind of lifestyle. And so they're just like, all right, I'm gonna be, you know, Tomb Raider / Indiana Jones.
Yeah, there's the guy from The Price who went off to be like the negotiator for this other alien civilization. He's just like, I really hate this whole Federation thing. I'm just gonna go, you know, make money working for somebody else. Mm-hmm. So apparently there is that option available to people. No, he didn't go work for Priceline, Chris.
You said he was
not
the negotiator.
That kind of negotiator. Thank you. So what do we think? Does Vash, whatever her name is, does she work better in DS9 than Q does? Is that what we're coming to? That she actually is useful in making comment on Federation society
and
this group of people?
I think she has much more of a place in this corner of the universe than Q has in this corner of the universe. You know, now that we're talking about it, I hadn't really thought about it before, but I wish they had come to Vash later in the series when they had, you know, already sort of kind of figured out what they wanted to say and, you know, how to be able to say it. So they could have brought Vash in and, you know, done something really nice with her, because it would have been nice to have a human, like you say, a human character come in and go, yeah, this whole enlightened utopia thing is really not for me. And, you know, have characters other than the best of the best crew of the Enterprise, you know, have, you know, because there's that scene later in the series between Jake and Nog, where Jake's like, well, we're enlightened. And Nog is like, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. Jake's like, I don't know, actually, but that's what they say. It's like,
they say,
you know, have that kind of a sentiment. And then bring Vash into that sentiment and, you know, have her go, yeah, I think it's kind of bullshit. And in some way, shape, or form, have some of the other main characters, whether it's Jake or whoever, go, maybe, I don't know. But I like my job.
Have Vash corrupt,
you know,
Jake.
Jake or, you know, Sisko or whoever, you know, or Bashir or, I don't know. But, you know, have attacked it at a time that they could have done more with it.
Yeah. Well, as you say, Brian, that's something DS9 did really well, I think, was questioning Star Trek itself. Questioning. Yeah. The Next Generation said, we don't have any money in the future. Everyone works for the greater good of mankind. You know, Earth is a paradise. The Federation is a paradise. Whereas DS9, I think, questioned The Next Generation a lot.
Yes.
Questioned everything that had been established. Because even in this episode, and Greg, you asked, did the writers actually think as deeply about it as we were saying there, that the whole little energy egg crystal, whatever it was a metaphor, you know, for the pursuit of wealth, and that those things that you try to attain is what will destroy you in the end or not. I'm not sure if they did there or not. And even if so, I'm not so sure that the message of this episode is that capitalism is bad and the Federation ideals are good. It could be the reverse. I mean, Q sits there at the end at the auction and says that, you know, Earth used to have character. It used to be an interesting place. Mm-hmm. Now it's just dull. And it's almost like the writer saying that this universe that was created in The Next Generation is dull.
Yeah, and that's a really interesting place to go with it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think they're just like, this is the very beginning of them working up the courage. And I don't know if that's exactly the right word, but the kind of the courage to say that. And then later on, you know, really tackle that idea. Because that's what I think they wanted to do from the outset. But, you know, at the beginning of the show, there's like, well, we don't know what to do. So let's start by making Next Generation again. And then hopefully we'll stop doing that at some point. And they do. But, beginning is that.
No, I thought courage was the right word, because there's so many times when, you know, the people who didn't like DS9, I heard them say, like, Gene Roddenberry would be rolling in his grave right now. I was like, well, first off, Gene Roddenberry is cremated, and so he's not rolling in his grave. And second, I mean, this, you know, we've done all that before. You know, we've done TNG. Let's do something different. Let's, you know, we're in the Bajoran sector. This is the frontier, you know, and I love it when Sisko says it's easy to turn a blind eye when you're in paradise. Well, they're no longer in paradise. Right. You know, the nearest fleet is a long ways away. They got to, you know, like, these are flawed people who make mistakes. But if on the bridge of the Enterprise, you have the best of the best of the best, and it's easy to be perfect when you're surrounded by perfection.
Yeah, and that's that's the essential quality. If you look at storytelling as like a didactic thing, as, you know, here's this answer I have about whatever aspect of human existence that I feel is worth communicating. I believe humans should do X generally as to live their lives. You know, I should not take revenge. I believe it's wrong for human beings to take revenge when they've been wronged, and they shouldn't do it. Okay, tell a story about, you know, a character not taking revenge. Well, if the entirety of that story is them not really being wronged in any serious way, and at the end they don't take revenge, it's like, well, that's not a great story, because there was no real trial there. There was no conflict. It's like, well, if the point of your story is, yes, we can create utopia, or we can make tomorrow better than yesterday, and we can fix the problems that we have, if there are no real great problems, if there are no challenges for us to be better people within the story, then it's like, well, that wasn't really great. To make the story great, you go, okay, we can make tomorrow better than yesterday, and then make it absolutely miserable hell for those characters to do it, and then still have them persevere at the end and accomplish that. It's like, that's a really great story, and that's, you know, that's where DS9 excels. As we've talked about in earlier episodes, I think where DS9 stumbles, at least for me personally, is they set up this question of, okay, utopia and progressivism, as Star Trek has already established it in its other incarnations, is that really possible? Can we really do that? And I think Deep Space Nine at the end comes back with the answer of no. Right. And that's the issue I have with Deep Space Nine. I love the fact that they asked the question, and they didn't take it for granted the way Roddenberry specifically kind of took it on faith. They really, you know, asked the question, but they didn't actually come back with the right answer, I think, personally.
Right, yeah. Very interesting.
Well, I don't know if they didn't come back with the right answer, but they didn't come back with the answer that Star Trek fans want, which is that
right.
future
exactly.
And that, you know, given attainable. Who I am, that could absolutely be it, because I believe I'm a progressive, and I believe in utopia, and I am both of those things precisely because of Star Trek. So I love that they were skeptical about it, but at the end of the day, that is what I believe, and they, they didn't come back with the answer I wanted. And, you know, it's totally fair.
But I mean, it's like I said, this is the Federation Old West.
Yeah.
And this is a dark Western. You know, this isn't one of the let's put together the posse and go after the bad guys. This is one of those ones Down
Front. I can tell Unforgiven. Somebody watched Unforgiven today.
Exactly. This is one of the ones where the line between good and bad is blurred. And you don't know at the end if good was served by any of what happened.
Yeah.
And the morality just isn't there. And, you know, like you say, that's not what Gene Roddenberry probably wanted. That's not what progressives think. But it's what they were at least trying for. At least they did have an agenda. They had an opinion, and they went for it with the show. And that's a really strong thing. And I think that's where Voyager can fall flat, because Voyager never felt like it had any sort of agenda.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not to... Yeah.
Not to belabor the point. I don't know if I know I've mentioned this several times on Down in Front. I don't know if I've mentioned it here, but I saw Nicholas Meyer, writer director of Star Trek II and director of Star Trek VI as well, at a Q&A once over the summer at a screening of Star Trek II. And he had a quote that has really stuck with me ever since, that I really think is the core of everything else, which is, you know, he said his quote goes along the lines of, you know, I want you, after I've told you a story, for you to understand why I sat you down and told the story in the first place. And that to me is like, okay, what was the point? Why did we go to all this trouble? Why did you spend millions of dollars and hundreds or thousands of man hours, you know, or 7 years in the case of a television show like this, making this thing? Like, what was the point of doing all of that in the first place? And like, there has to be, in every case, movie, television show, whatever, you know, that's core idea of like, okay, this is why I'm telling you the story. This is the point of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, Deep Space Nine definitely has that. It has that overarching idea. And Voyager does not. It's just television.
And I think this again brings us back to Q-less, because at the end of Q-less, my question is, why did Robert Hubert Wolf sit us down to tell us this story? And we've talked about Q, we talked about Vash, but like the A story of the episode is the ship's being pulled towards the wormhole and no one knows why.
Yeah.
And they do spend the whole, Q makes fun of it, but nevertheless, they spend the whole episode teching the tech and trying to figure out what it is. And then at the end, what happens? They figure out what it is and they beam it. Like That's the heroic action. They beamed a thing into space.
And then they throw in the ending from Encounter at Farpoint.
Right.
Except instead of a jellyfish, it's the golden energy manta ray that flies off to the into the wormhole, right?
And there's not two of them. I was waiting for it to, like, we should have followed it into the wormhole and had it meet its friend.
And their tails touch.
Yeah. Touch the tails. Like, if you're going to do Farpoint, damn it, do Farpoint.
That's right. Oh, but
I feel like it was just a plot device. You know, it was just something that needed to bring peril to the episode. I mean, I'd like to say that there was more. I'd like to say that there was this overarching story and lesson to be learned. But it was really just, hey, let's do a Q episode. Let's introduce Q by introducing Vash. That way we can get a TNG feel. Oh, crap, we need some peril. Otherwise, what's the point? How are we going to promote this episode in the ads? That's how they did it. I mean, I hate to be that kind of cynical, but I really feel like it was a patchwork job. And that was our device, was that, you know, manta ray.
Well, I think you're probably right there, Tristan. I think that when we watch the episode, we can find, like we're talking about here, the idea of the capitalist society versus the, you know, socialist society, and the ideals of the Federation, and whether TNG's future is realistic or not. We can see that. We can follow it through the episode. But yeah, I don't necessarily think that they were really going for that message. I could be wrong. Maybe that's what they were going for. But yeah, I think it was a let's do a Q episode and let's bring Vash back and then let's kind of figure. Because the ending of the episode when they go to the window and they beam the thing out and they're standing at the window and then they see it turn into the energy manta ray, and no one really says anything, right? They just kind of look at each other, and they'll look, even Vash especially, the look's almost like, okay, so this is what the whole episode was about.
So this is what we're doing.
This is what we're doing this week. Bars of gold press Latinum or whatever.
Yeah, right. All right, well,
it's like you don't want your characters. I talked about the coffee and bagels moment that's from Patton Oswalt, but I talked about it a couple weeks ago. You don't want to have your characters have a coffee and bagels moment.
Yeah, that would be bad.
It's like, really? Yeah. I woke up in the morning and made coffee so that we could beam it into space and so it could be a manta ray.
I drove on the 405 during rush hour to get here at 6 a.m. and made these fucking bagels and coffee so you could have an energy manta ray at the end.
Was this kind of like a Voyager threshold moment where Paris and Janeway are slugs at the end of the episode? Because
it's just
not,
like that.
Well,
that was at least humorous at the end. You know, we at least had the benefit of seeing lizard babies crawl into scum. You know, that made the whole episode worth it for me.
Oh man, I'm still waiting for the non-canon novel where we find out what happened to the lizard babies.
I, you know, it's while I agree with all the criticisms we've laid, and I don't think this is a great episode, and blah, blah, as somebody who works in film production as my job, I have to come to the defense at any point possible and say, you know, it's sometimes you're just trying to get to the end of the day. And especially, I've never worked in television production myself, but, you know, that's, from what I understand, is the harshest environments known to man. It's like you had these deadlines. And so it's like, you need a draft and like, okay. And sometimes, and you, if you read the trivia on the Memory Alpha stuff, it's like, you can find all these, you know, interview quotes of, you know, people behind the scenes and their stuff for Kula. So it's like, yeah, that wasn't a good one. You know, we just, we had to get to 5 o'clock that day. And, you know, that was,
you win some, you lose some.
So that's what we went with.
Right. Yeah, I mean, and Larry talked about that a lot last week about how, you know, even what was that middle of the fifth season of Next Gen, they didn't have a script and they just did this one and it didn't really pan out like they wanted it to. But it's just production gets away from you and it's something.
It's a constant, you know, it's a treading water situation. You're just constantly trying to stay ahead of this.
Yeah.
This horrible, horrible wave that never goes away.
I mean, every episode cannot be a fantastic script. So
That's how we can at least pull out of it, though, the things we did like about it. I think we've talked about that a little bit. There is, intended or not, there is that commentary on capitalism that's quite interesting. I do think the interaction between Quark and Vash is actually really interesting and really fascinating and is, you know, like part of A Complete Breakfast. It's part of a good episode. It just wasn't this time, but it totally could have been.
The value of this is like, you know, the beginnings of what will prove to be really wonderful episodes.
Exactly.
A really great television show. It's like, okay, here's the seeds of that, and it's like, okay, well, it's still just dirt right now, but in it are seeds, and so we just give it some time, then we get something good.
No, all you guys are wrong. Okay, all you guys are wrong. The best part of the episode and the great thing that came out of this episode that I think we all need to reflect on is Odo contemplating having a platinum-plated bucket.
That's true.
Oh, that was a good moment.
My absolute favorite moment, because he's like, Quark's like, I could get you a platinum-plated bucket, and then he looks off into the distance, and it does that Odo trademark scoff.
It's like the moment that Data spent contemplating, like, going away with the Borg Queen. It's Odo, you know, there in his head thinking, gold platinum plated bucket.
Exactly. Yes.
Which are both great moments, because it's like, you know, if somebody always blindly answers one way or the other, then it shows that they're not thinking about it. When they take that moment, it's like, well, okay, you still got to come up with the right answer at the end, but take the moment to think about it, because it's good to think about things.
Yeah.
And so, totally take that moment and be like, do I want that? No, I don't want that. But I thought about it, so I feel good about myself.
Right.
Now, I did mean to ask you guys, now, have you ever used stories of taking standardized tests or graduation exams, you know, to try to pick up a girl before?
I was going to mention this. I think the writers of this episode had it out for Julian, because he is the worst. Like in that scene where he's telling about the ligaments or whatever, and then he hits
I'm
on
sorry,
Vash.
Greg, it's a pre-ganglionic fiber, which he confused with a post-ganglionic nerve.
Rookie
Excuse
mistake.
Me.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a trick question.
Yeah.
Okay. So he's
in his defense.
Brian, you are also the worst.
But this girl
Look,
was.
Brian,
fine.
I don't care about your story. We are not going out with you.
Okay, so he does that, and then he hits on Vash. And then Q puts him to sleep. It's like that scene in Phantom Menace where Jar Jar gets so annoying that Qui-Gon actually does a Vulcan neck pinch on him and puts him to sleep for the next 5 minutes.
And did you notice what Q said after he did that? It was really, I actually have missed it before. I notice it when I'm just listening to audio.
I didn't notice.
Bashir says like, oh yeah, I am feeling a bit sleepy. And he starts to walk off and Q says something like, yeah, why don't you go to your bed and get some rest by yourself for a change?
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
I did catch that this time. I was like, wow, that's kind of sharp for Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
Although after that then, comes one of my favorite moments of the episode, which is just when O'Brien notices that the Bajoran waiter is Q, and O'Brien just goes, bloody hill and then leaves. I love O'Brien.
He said that a couple of times this episode. He's like a...
He did.
But that moment when he said it, it was just such... What I love about Cole Meany as O'Brien is I really think he's one of the most natural actors on any of the Star Trek series. And
him
that
and
moment
Kelly
was,
are like the two, like you guys are just human. You guys are real people.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I don't question that for a second.
Yeah. And I just
love
that
moment. I did feel like he was a little too much. I was on the Enterprise.
Well,
he repeated that a lot in this episode.
I was going to call
this. Remember me? I was on the Enterprise.
Yeah. I was going to call this episode. Who are you again?
Yeah.
Do I know you?
Right.
Because Vash is like, how do you know that? Or and I was on the Enterprise, and then Q,
right.
And who are you?
I love the image that it conjures up. I've always loved the, you know, because I made a minorly popular internet video called the Agent Stormtrooper, which the premise of it is, you know, you have your typical Star Wars laser fight and the rebels leave, but then we stay with the Stormtrooper and one of them is injured. I always love this idea of like the extras or the faceless, you know, Stormtroopers or whatever, and like them, the background characters to the main thing and making them the main characters. And I just love the image that this conjures of like, you know, O'Brien was a background character that graduated to being a main character in Deep Space Nine.
Right, yeah.
And so this image that it conjures, you just picture O'Brien in the transporter room just watching a Q episode as it happens on the Enterprise going, oh, bloody hell, these people are out of their fucking gourds. God Christ almighty. And it's like, which must be the case for every rank and file red and yellow shirt on every other Enterprise. Just like, what are they doing this week? What is happening?
Right.
Other galaxy, wall of energy? What?
It's kind of like a...
Right. I really...
Neelix in Voyager, like I think first season, like they go into a nebula, what they think is a nebula, but it was actually inside the belly of a space monster. And
a space Moby Dick.
Yeah, basically. And Neelix was
Star
just
Wars
like
didn't
so
do that already.
Fed up. He just couldn't handle it anymore. He's like,
right.
He's like, these people have a starship. They have everything that they could possibly need. And instead of going home, they're going into the, like, they go into, laser battles. They go into the space Moby Dick.
Doesn't he tells that to Kes, doesn't he? About how crazy Janeway is for investigating every little thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And he goes and complains to Janeway.
And it's that sentiment that I love, and you really feel like that comes across in this episode with O'Brien. It's like, oh crap, it's Q. Oh, jeez,
right.
It's gonna be one of those
it's like
days.
He wants to. If you feel like he wants to sit everyone down and just explain to them how this is gonna go.
Yeah,
because they have no idea.
Like, listen, no
it's
one's gonna
be
get
annoying.
Hurt. Yeah, no one's gonna get hurt.
Right.
Nothing. No one's gonna die. You're just gonna get mildly annoyed, and your time's gonna be wasted.
Right.
You know. So.
Yeah.
Right.
All right. Well, to wrap up our discussion, I guess, of this episode, why don't we just touch one more time on Q himself, though, Greg, because I know you wanted to talk about Q. And I think our basic, what we've come to here is that Q works well as a Next Generation character, not as a DS9 character, and so-so as a Voyager character. And if you were to, let's just say J.J. Abrams were to decide that he's going to bring Q back at some point, is that anything that you would want to see?
Ah, so
that would be an utter disaster,
interesting.
Oh man, can you imagine no Q in a J.J. Abrams film, as every time he snaps his fingers, 50 billion lens flares go all over the place?
Shoom, shoom, shoom.
Sorry, go ahead.
I did
Greg.
Notice how actually kind of bad the flash effect was. Like, I know they just have everybody stand there still and then have John DeLancey like walk out of frame and then they start again. But I was noticing like jumps like every time they did it. And there were a lot of flashes and a lot of little jumps. And that was just standing out to me this time. So hopefully JJ would at least get that right. But if they brought him back, the way to do Q for me at this point is you've got to examine like new things about him. That's why Voyager went with the whole procreation aspect and the death of the Q continuum, like the Civil War. That actually was a good idea, I think, to get into that, because Q as a person, just Q as an antagonist, stops being quite as interesting. It's sort of, I'm going to mention Battlestar Galactica.
So say we all!
So say we all!
Baltar is sort of the cue of the show for the first season and a half, where he's just there to kind of be funny. I mean, he's doing stuff, but he's kind of just there to be funny. But they have to keep finding new things to do with him. You know, let's make him the president. Let's make him go be with the Cylons. Let's make him do all this stuff. Because if you're not throwing new challenges at him, if you're just having this guy come back to be an antagonist, to become comedic relief, it gets really, really boring. And that's what this episode did. Like, they didn't think of anything new to do with Q, and they put him in with this crew that he didn't mesh with, and it just fell flat. So, yeah. What Voyager learned, I think what JJ could do in this horrific theoretical situation is at least throw something new at him, make him mortal, make him the last of the Q, something like that.
Yeah, I think, well, John DeLancey actually has a quote here on Memory Alpha that I think is very true. It says, Q is best used when he deals with large philosophical issues, and skirt chasing just isn't one of them. And I think that's... And it's something that can be leveled at Next Generation as much as this episode of DS9. The Robin Hood episode is kooky, I guess, and the bit with Worf smashing the ukulele, that's funny. But at the end of the day, it's like, that was a Q episode. Like, why did... Q can do anything he wants. Why did he do that? And it has that same feeling in this episode. It's like, why did he do that? Why was he there? What was he doing? Why was he with Vash? Yeah. What was the point of all that? It's like, and especially Q was introduced in the pilot as this, you know, grand inquisitor of human intentions and human motives. And like, are you really good enough? Are you really as good as you say? All of these grand ideals that you claim to believe in, are you really living up to them? And like, that's a really big philosophical question, and arguably the question that could be, even if it, you know, at the center of all of Star Trek. And so that's great, and that's something worthy of a character like that, of a character that can do and be anything that he wants and go anywhere and whatever. So that's what Q is at his best, clearly. And then we have episodes like this, which is not that.
And that,
I think that's a mistake.
And that's why Q in a J.J. Abrams film would never work, because the philosophy is gone. You know, and I'm not bashing J.J. Abrams at all, because I love what he did with Star Trek 09. But well, you go ahead. I'm going
to
keep my
Blu-ray. Just to be
clear,
I am.
Yeah. You know, like J.J. Abrams' Star Trek is all about action and phasers and starships, which is fine, you know, because Star Trek has a large section of that. But also another large section of
Star Wars too.
Yeah, another large section of Star Trek is philosophy, and Q is 90% philosophy, 10% snide, you know, childish. And
when he's done well, yes. But there are other times when he's 90% childish and 10 or less percent philosophy, and that's when he doesn't work so well.
Right.
Right. Well, yeah, in Encounter at Farpoint and Around All Good Things, Q, as John DeLancey said, yes, dealing with the big philosophical issues. That's what the Q character is all about. Mm-hmm. In this episode, he's taking all the way from those big philosophical issues to a contestant on The Price is Right. When during the auction, when one of the guys bids 2,500 bars of gold pressed latinum, and then Q bids 2,501 bars of gold pressed latinum.
Right.
Oh, but yeah, Brian, you mentioned earlier about the show having a series, having a clear starting point, and when you get to the end, you know why you took the journey. And, you know, DS9 had that, and you said Voyager didn't. I would also say that thanks to Q, the Next Generation did have that because of the philosophical issue. Now, every single episode of the Next Generation maybe didn't support that journey, but from Encounter at Farpoint all the way to the end of All Good Things, when Picard finds himself back in the same courtroom as Encounter at Farpoint. And some of my very, very favorite lines in all of Star Trek is what Q tells Picard there, that, you know, the journey never ends. And, you know, the last 7 years have been part of this trial. But, you know, the exploration of the unknown, that's the big great beyond. The Next Generation had that. You knew when you got to the end of The Next Generation why you sat through 7 years of that series.
Right.
And that was thanks to Q. So I totally agree with John Delancey there on how Q should be used. And and as for J.J. Abrams bringing back Q, which I guess is a maybe, is this a rumor that we're going to start, Greg? Is this like the...
Very possibly, yeah.
We've already speculated that the Triple King will be in the next movie, as well as the... that Benedict Cumberbatch will be playing Landru from Return of the Archons. Right. So.
Landru or Khan or Cybok or all three using digital effects.
Well, I can say I do have insider knowledge in the fact that these actually the same events that Nicholas Meyer was at, Ortsey, Kurtzman, and Lindelof were also at. They also showed EO9 Star Trek. And at their Q&A, they said that the Mirror Universe will definitely not be part of this new movie. And somebody mentioned, some fan asked him like jokingly, whether like, I think it was Harry Mudd, I think was the question she asked, like, Harry Mudd going to be? And they're like, no, Harry Mudd is not going to be.
No.
How did that get started? I mean, right when the sequels was announced, everybody was saying Harry Mudd, Harry Mudd, Harry Mudd. Why?
It's crazy.
Why? Yeah, where did it come from?
Some people
because
wanted
he showed
to
up
see
twice,
Jack
and
Black.
Anything that shows up twice sticks in people's brains, and people just go with what they remember. I mean, that's all there is.
Well, you know,
if it happens more than once, you're more likely to remember it, and therefore it's important, even if it's not actually important.
Well, you know, Ensign Leffler showed up twice, so can I expect to see Ashley Judd in the next movie?
It always comes back to Leffler with you.
Ensign Leffler.
That'd be fantastic.
Ensign Leffler is a great character. It's like that. There's a great example of just here's kind of your standard run-of-the-mill human being in this world who's still an interesting and quirky human being that is different from all the other run-of-the-mill human beings. Anyway, that's a total tangent, but yeah, I like that.
All right, guys. Well, it's been a good discussion today. Was I think the first time that we've really talked about Q at any length on this show. So thanks for joining us. And Tristan, before we go, why don't you tell everyone where they can find you? Obviously, everyone knows you from Hyper Channel, but what else do you have going on?
You can find me on Twitter at The Insane Robin, and that's my personal Twitter. And pretty much just I try to follow any and all Star Trek fans I can get a hold of. I mean, if you follow me, just let me know and tell me, hey, I'm a Star Trek fan. I heard you on the Ready Room, and I will follow you right back. The reason why I'm doing this podcast with you guys and why I do Hyper Channel is because if you're listening to this podcast, I'm obsessed with Star Trek. So, so please follow me and let's have a discussion. And also, I'm starting a podcast. I have a few stories in the bank. It's called 10 Forward. It's where I try to find your average Joe Star Trek fans and find their personal stories about how they got started watching Star Trek, how Star Trek has changed their lives, or how it's affected their viewpoint on life. Like Brian has said, I mean, he's a progressive person, in a big part due to Star Trek. I want to hear those stories. I want to hear how long you've been a fan. And, I just contact me, at Twitter and, we'll talk, we'll Skype, that way we can get everybody to hear your story and just keep them coming.
All right. And Brian, tell everybody where they can find you as well.
You can find me on Twitter at, my normal name, Brian Finifter, is my Twitter handle. It's BrianFinifter. Yeah, I know it's tough. Just deal with it. and unlike Tristan, I don't follow everybody. So please follow me if you want, but I'm not going to follow you back. I'm telling you that right now.
Oh, I don't follow everyone. I follow Star Trek fans.
Okay, all right. Yeah, even, even if you're a Star Trek fan, I probably don't care.
This is pure honesty from Brian here.
You also don't tweet, Brian. Yes. I follow you, and I have never seen a single tweet from you.
No, I tweet. I try to only say something when I have something worth saying.
Brian uses the average corporate model, which is to set up a Twitter account and tweet once every 3 weeks,
yeah,
right?
You know, it's kind of ironic. I have a personal assistant to do my tweeting for me. And actually, ironically, my personal assistant is Barack Obama. So it's kind of backwards. Yeah. And then I do his Twitter account. Anyway, you can also find me. I'm a host on a podcast called Down in Front. We record for the time being. We record our own commentaries to movies. And so we like you have a DVD and it comes with a director's commentary track where it's the director talking about the film. It's like that, except instead of the director, it's just us. And most of the time we have absolutely nothing to do with the film. But we just talk about it. We have a conversation about it or whatever strikes our fancy as we talk about it. And you can find that at downinfront.net. And we'll actually be changing formats in the very near future. So we'll be kind of shifting more towards a more traditional podcast that'll be about movies and television and the business. I live in Los Angeles. I work in the movie business, and my other three co-hosts all do as well. So it's kind of about the business, but about movies as well. So downinfront.net is the place for that. And we also have a Twitter at downinfront on Twitter. And if you like movies or television at all, check it out.
Yeah. And the great thing is, even though you're not doing any more commentaries after next month, you've done so many. You've been doing the show for three years. So if there's a movie that you love, Down in Front's probably already done a commentary for it. So just check the archive and go ahead and check it out.
We have somewhere between 150 and 200 commentaries, I think, at this point. And so we've also recently started doing an accessory show called The Intermission, which is more of a traditional, we'll just pick a topic and talk about it for half an hour. So there's that as well. And there's all kinds of interest. So go to the website and see if there's any topic that you think might be interesting and check it out.
All right. Well, excellent, guys. Well, thanks again for joining us today.
Always a pleasure.
See you guys.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks.
See you next time.
So it's probably not the best idea to start a retrospective of Q by doing his DS9 episode. I thought it might be an interesting way to sort of subvert it and come at it from an interesting angle. And I think we did. We managed to talk about Q and DS9 at the same time. Hopefully we'll revisit Q in one of his stronger, maybe one of his TNG episodes in the near future. And
yeah,
wrap our heads around that more philosophical Q that everyone really does love.
Yeah, that, or as Tristan had mentioned, Death Wish from Voyager, which is another very good
fantastic
Q story. But it was fun to talk about this one. I mean, I don't dislike this episode, but if we're gonna dissect it as whether it's a strong episode overall or not, or whether it's a strong Q episode, then I think you get what we ended up with in our discussion in the feature. It's an okay episode to pass through as you pass through season one DS9. But at any rate, it was still fun to talk about it. Q is one of my favorite parts of Star Trek. So good. All right. Yeah. Now, Greg, I think we did miss something. Now, I got a memo, and I thought that we were going to be discussing OS X Mountain Lion in this episode of The Ready Room, and I think we forgot
going
to do that.
To.
So we'll save that for a supplementary show, I guess.
One of these days, I was telling you on the other side of the room that I have a show topic. If we did a show one every day, we could do our Mac show, our Battlestar show, our just like news show. All these shows we could do, Chris. Just say the word. I'm totally on it.
Yeah, I think we could keep at least 5 days a week, if not 7 days a week, a new show. Although we'd have to start making some money somehow, so we could hire some people to edit these shows for us, I think.
Yes.
If we do that.
Well, we need to get, if Brian's got Barack Obama working for him, maybe he can lend us some of Barack's time.
Yeah, maybe so. All right. Well, why don't we tell people how they can contact us, especially so they can send us all the hate mail about our your attempt, anyway, to spread rumors about Chris Pine.
Unsubstantiated. I'm not saying that I have solid high-level sources. I'm just saying I have a lot of high-level sources.
But they're not solid. All right. I think that bit certainly has a life of its own, I'd say, anyway. Now, as it enters its fourth or fifth week, I don't know. I've lost count. But
yes, something like
that. But anyway, if you do want to contact us, you can always send us a text message by going to the website at trek.fm/contact. And you can find us on Twitter, which is what most people do. Our username is trekfm. Very easy. And Greg, people can find you on Twitter as well.
That's right. I'm there at Greg Harbin. That's GREGHARB as in boy, IN. You'll find me mostly at replying Amber E, aka Rare Basement, who's a Twitter personality and general funny girl who I've become obsessed with, and she actually started following me the other day. So I'm hoping to become something of a Twitter celebrity myself in the coming weeks. So follow me now before it gets out of control.
All right. Well, you got a lot of competition, Greg, because you know you've got Mike Harbin who's trying to do the same thing, and
he's coming up, you know, on me. Yeah,
you gotta fight him off. Got a little bit of that second chances thing going there, I think. So
our listeners have no idea what we're talking about.
That's true.
But go ahead, Dan. Where can we find you on Twitter?
Well, you can find me at D Brian. No, I'm kidding. It's C Brian Jones. That's Brian with a Y and a C at the beginning. And you'll find me tweeting about all kinds of things. And sometimes at replying Greg as he at replies his new Twitter crush. But you can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm and on Google Plus at Hyperchannel/TrekFMG+, and talk to us there. You can have all the characters in the world that you want. So, Greg, I think I'm going to head on out now. I got to go put in my bid for some of those authentic Gamma Quadrant artifacts.
All right, Chris, I think it's time to stick some gold-pressed Latinum in it, because the Ready Room is done.